rid of her. She's also known very much related to everyone has heard of her loss of ethical egoism, which each person is trying to advance either up her own, or you can, each person is trying to advance his or her own interests. Oh, that's better. Maybe I should talk, I should warn you, I generally have a fairly low voice, so I'll try to get a bit louder. You can see the Mises Institute books in the background, just the Institute library. My library is not quite as large as it. Okay, I'll try to be as clear as possible. I'm not in the screen, so. All right, so as you know, her system is, ethical system is one egoism. That to say, each person is supposed to advance his or her own interest. And she has a book called The Virtue of Selfishness, where she condemns altruism. Now, she's not a defender of selfishness in the sense in which we have to imagine that you're served dessert and the people at the party, and you're all served dessert, and somebody grabs all the dessert for himself and doesn't leave anything for anybody else. She's not an advocate of selfishness in that sense. She means selfishness in the sense of egoism, but not behaving badly. But, hello? How about, is that any better? It's not working too well. Well, I don't know. Some people are hearing me, some not. I'll try to talk really loud. All right, so although she doesn't accept selfishness in the sense of behavior that we consider boorish, like just taking things from other people, she does condemn altruism very strongly. She said in a free market, she thinks that there'd be some people who might not be able to maintain themselves if they were just on their own. They would have to have support from other people. She thinks there would be much fewer of those than there would be in a under a socialist or interventionist economy. But she doesn't think that, she thinks those people would be helped voluntarily, but she doesn't think that's a big deal. It wouldn't be an ethical requirement that we help people who can't help themselves in the free market. So here, her views are very much in conflict with conventional opinion. So she can't be equated in her views with the character in the P.G. Woodhouse novel who says to Jeeves, the butler, whenever anything comes up, I always ask myself one question, what's in it for me? She's not as selfish in this kind of narrow way that someone's always asking, how can I do best immediately out of what's in my own interest? But she is an egoist in the sense that each person has as his primary goal advancing his own well-being. This is, in helping other people is something of secondary significance. So, as I say, she's best known for her novel defending free enterprise capitalism and her philosophy of ethical egoism. But these aren't the primary, what she thought was the most fundamental part of her philosophy. These were practical conclusions. These were what we have. These are the things that would result from putting her philosophy into practice in ethics and politics. but these aren't the fundamental principles. She thought there's an underlying principles in philosophy that are more basic than ethics and politics, and then asked her, what did she think was more fundamental? The key to what this more fundamental part of the philosophy is, we can get this from the name of the philosophy, which is objectivism. Sometimes people call her philosophy Randianism, people who aren't disciples, but she wouldn't like that. They don't, people who are official objectivists don't call themselves Randians, but they call themselves objectivists. So, we'll try to do better the next time I'm talking as loud as I can. I'm sorry. Yeah, next week when we were practicing this at home, it was much better, but I think on this particular computer, at the Mises Institute, we're having a bit of problems. So I hope nobody drops out, because this would be very much against my self-interest. So please stay with us in course if you can. So by objectivism, she meant that philosophy has as its primary goal the accurate grasp of existence. Now, at first, this seems like an odd point to emphasize, because if she's saying what she wants is to grasp truth, who would say that doesn't want to grasp the truth? There might be a few skeptics who would deny the possibility of getting truth, but wouldn't everybody, no matter what their philosophy was, say that what they wanted to do was to arrive at the truth? But she didn't see it that way at all. In her view, the history of philosophy can be seen as a battle between those philosophers who give primacy to existence, she thought that was the correct view, and those who defend what she calls the primacy of consciousness. So to make this view, her view of the history of philosophy, plausible, we have to grasp what did she mean by existence. You know her famous slogan, she always said, existence exists. What did she mean by that? Well, by existence, Rand meant primarily the physical world, that's to say, the world that's disclosed to our senses and studied by science. So the world is, say, you're now looking at a computer screen, and I'm seeing a computer screen. We have all sorts of objects in front of us. We all know what the physical world is. So it's basically whatever is composed of matter. She didn't have any fixed view of what the ultimate constituents of matter was. But she said, well, look, no one can really deny there's a world out there. There's a physical world. And this is what she really meant by existence. She said, we don't really get the concept of a physical world till sometime. It isn't the immediate thing we grasp as soon as we're conscious. We have the notion that something's out there, but we always are aware that there's something out there that's different from our own mind. And she thought mind was really subordinate to reality, in the sense that you could think of mind as not having a content in itself, but is just directed towards something. Suppose I say, I'm thinking, I'm thinking. Suppose I say, I'm just thinking, and you say, what are you thinking about? And I say, well, I'm not thinking about anything, I'm just thinking. Or suppose I said, I'm looking, but I'm not looking at anything, I'm just looking. That, in her view, wouldn't make sense. But an act of the mind, like thinking or looking, always has to be directed outward at reality. Now, sometimes I could have some idea in my mind. I could say I just have a mental picture of something, but she thought that was secondary. Any kind of mental content would have to be derived from something in the external world. So consciousness is really secondary to reality, to existence. Existence is the world, what's there outwardly, and then consciousness tries to get an accurate view of that world. The consciousness isn't primary. Consciousness is directed outward. So she certainly didn't deny that the mind exists. She doesn't. There are some philosophers who behaviorists would be an example, who don't think there is such a thing as the mind. They just think there's a behavior. And, you know, the old joke about the behaviorist meets another behaviorist on the street. He says to him, you're fine, how am I? So the behaviorists don't believe in the mind at all. Remember, that was a joke that I made to Friedrich Hayek last. So Grand was not a behavior. She thought there definitely are minds, but minds don't have independent content. They're directed outward at the world. And she didn't think also that minds were composed of some sort of separate mental substance, like Descartes did. It isn't that there's some immaterial substance that constitutes the mind. It's just mind is a principle of organization of certain kinds of matter, human beings, and mind is directed outward. Now, given these, yes, that's right, Bishop Berkeley is coming up. He had the view that with a subjective idealist, he had the view that only mind exists. There's no matter, it's just a superstition. So she wouldn't accept that view. That would be one she would very strongly reject. She said, well, look, no, there's a physical world out there that's basic. The mind is just directed outward. That Now, also, she rejected the view that says there's a separately existing realm of universal. What do I mean by universal? Well, supposing, let's take a concept such as red, we say there are all sorts of things that are red, red apple, red pencil, red paint. We could list all sorts of things that have a particular quality. So the quality that all these things have in common, redness, is called the universal property. You can find in all sorts of different things. So some philosophers said that these properties, these universals, are separately existing entities. It's not just that, say, we find pencils that are red, pens that are red, paint that's red, all sorts of things that are red, but redness is itself something that exists apart from particular physical objects that are red. So that would be a view that called realism about universes. So she didn't accept that. She didn't think there's a separately existing world of universal. She thought that what exists or just is just the physical world. We'll see very soon how she get what she thought about property, but they're not an independent realm. There isn't this independent realm of universal. And mind, she rejects idealism, the view that there's no, only mind exists, no matter. She believes in existence of mind, but it's not composed of some kind of separate mental substance. It's not a materialist view, but it's closer, much closer to materialism than to idealism. Now, given this way of looking at things, it's not surprising that Rand condemned Plato. Plato thought that there is a separately existing world of form. Now, by this, it was pretty much what I said about, which I said about universal, where I said, it, according to this real view of realism about universal, it isn't just that they're separately, that they're red objects, red pencils, red paint, but there's redness itself. So he really went all the way with this view of realism. In fact, you could call his view realism about universal by an LSD trip. What he said was not only are there realism about properties, redness, but objects themselves are just copies of ideal objects that exist. For example, suppose I said that a house exists. If I talk about a house that's actually out there, that would just be a copy of some sort of ideal house that existed in a kind of separate realm. Physical objects were just a copy of this ideal world of forms. And then in his view, all these forms are unified under a still higher form called the form of the good. There's different views as to how he wanted these various forms related. But you see, in this view, in Plato's view, there are various interpretations that the physical world, the world that's given to us in the senses, looks strictly subordinate significant, because what's really important is this world of form. So Rand took this view, this Platonic view, to be a denial of reality. And you see why she would think that, because what she says is reality are the physical world. So this view is saying, no, the physical world is a very, just a pale shadow of the real world. The real world for Plato is this world of form. So she said, no, this is denying what the real world of existence. Now the question is, the world of forms referring, Michael asked, is the world of forms referring to abstract knowledge? Well, that's part of what it refers to, but it can also refer to quite what we would think of as quite concrete things like ordinary property. So it's sort of the world we see is really a copy of this world of forms, which has kind of a separate existence. It's not really mental, but it's not physical either. And then there are various views in different Platonic dialogues exactly what's included in this world of forms. So, as I say, Rand really rejected this view. She said, no, this is not the correct view of things. If you take this view, then you're denying existence, you're denying the world of the senses. And she thought that the influence of Plato on the history of philosophy, the whole tradition of Plato, the bad one, That's right. Nathan, as far as the basic concept, it exists independently of the mind. Yes, I think that's a very good way of looking at it. So Plato, as you know, has been very influential. Alfred North Whitehead, in his book 1929, Process and Reality, said the history of philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. And so, which is not far from the truth. So if you take Rand's view, then the whole history of philosophy, a great deal of it, has something wrong with it because it's taking this view that that the world of the senses, the ordinary world that we know, isn't the primary world. Now, she also, Paul Smith, Paul asked, how can there be a concept without a mind to conceive it? Well, that's a very good question, but Plato thought that forms are not just mental entities, but he thought it was kind of, they can't really be characterized as mental entities, but they're kind of just way to think of it, just imagine kind of a property like redness just existing by itself without any not concrete instances of a property, but just the property itself. If this makes no sense to you, well, probably that's a good indication you'd be a good objector. But to some philosophers, it has made sense to think of properties in that way. So in addition to these other faults, this fault, namely denying that the world given in the senses is primary, Paul is saying redness is a function of cone in your eyeball. That wouldn't be a Platonic view of things. Very definitely not. It might be, well, it won't be a correct view, but it's not Plato. So besides this fault, or related to this fault, of denying the primacy of the physical world, she thought that Plato philosophy was really a type of mysticism. And what's a mystic is a very bad word in Rand's vocabulary, because what sense was it mystical? Well, Plato thought that the philosopher could gain direct insight into this world of forms without reference to the senses. It isn't that, according to Plato, you would get knowledge by abstraction from senses. It wouldn't be, say, that we would look at a lot of red objects and then get the concept of red from that. That wouldn't be basic for Plato. We could, according to Plato, have a direct knowledge of the universal without reference to the senses. And Rand takes this to be a type of mysticism. Now, Plato's main enemy, according to Rand, was also Plato's best-known student, Aristotle. And Aristotle is the philosopher that she considers the best philosopher of antiquity. And she sees herself as carrying on Aristotle's philosophy with improvements. She thinks that Aristotle retained certain elements of Plato's philosophy, but he essentially purged Plato of the errors that were contained in that philosophy. Specifically, Plato and Aristotle emphasized knowledge gained through the senses. Aristotle thought we don't know things unless we first grasp them through the senses, and then we abstract from the senses, and we can then get, you know, abstract concepts once we start with the physical senses. But Aristotle was very much kind of much more down to earth than Plato, in addition to being a philosopher, he was also a biologist, did a great deal of investigation of various animals on motion of animals. He was really one of the first great biologists, which was also a great philosopher. And he disagreed with Plato. Plato thought there's an independent realm of universal, this world of forms. Aristotle denied this. He said, well, there are properties, but these properties are found only in physical objects. So there's such a thing as redness, according to Aristotle. You only find redness in physical objects. As we'll see later, Aristotle's view of universal is not the same as Rand, but it's much closer to Rand's view than Plato's view. Plato said, here is this independent realm of universals that exists entirely apart from the senses, but Aristotle said, no, that's not right. Now, one other point that's very important to grasp Rand is, as the earlier reference to mysticism suggests, when I said Rand condemns Plato's philosophy as a type of mysticism, she rejected belief in God. Atheism for Rand is a fundamental principle. We can see from what I've said so far why she would say that, why she would be an atheist. Because remember, for her, the physical world is primary. Physical world is given to our senses, is primary. So suppose God exists, where we take God in the usual sense to be the creator of the world, remembering Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. So on this view, if God exists and is the creator, then the physical world is controlled by God's mind. So this rejects existence. I see this, I can't spell existence. You can see this in the slide. Maybe this shows that I'm unduly influenced by mysticism. So you see, it's a very unusual way of defending atheism to say, well, if God existed, then we would be saying that mind is primary over existence. Existence is the world given to the senses, but that, according to her, is not the case. It's the world of the senses that's primary, so we can't recognize God or any other spiritual entity that would claim that the physical world is subject to its control. As far as I know, that's kind of their original argument for atheism. At least I've never seen that argument from anyone else. Now, despite her atheism, let me see, there's a question here that I missed, sorry. Adam asked, where does this all fit at all with man is the measure of all things? Well, it depends. She would, to a large extent, disagree with Protagoras in that she's not saying that human beings are what determines reality. She thinks there really is a physical world out there, and man has to subordinate himself to that world. Man has to directly grasp that world. But that world, the physical world, is what's out there. That's the primary thing. So she's rejecting any view that would subordinate that physical world to something mental if you said, well, if God had created the world, then you'd be saying the world is subordinate to something ultimately spiritual. She doesn't accept that. So despite her atheism, she takes a very favorable view of Thomas Aquinas, the greatest medieval Catholic philosopher. You might say, well, how could you do that? Because Aquinas was someone who not only believed in God, but thought he could prove that God exists. So you think, well, wouldn't someone who is an atheist like Rand really be very critical of Aquinas? But she wasn't. Of course, she rejected his belief in God, but she thought he was very good because he really developed Aristotle's philosophy in certain ways more further than Aristotle had. She moved on ethics and emotions and various other topics. He really contributed to Aristotelian philosophy. She thinks that he broke with the Platonism of the earlier Middle Ages. There are some people who take Aquinas to be quite the follower of Plato in many respects, but she doesn't agree with that interpretation. She says, no, Aquinas was someone who was really breaking with Plato as an Aristotelian. And in the Rand's view, in the view of philosophers such as Leonard Peikoff, who accept her conception of the history of philosophy, it was a revived Aristotelian philosophy of the Middle Ages, of Aquinas, that was principally responsible for the Renaissance. We sometimes, Ernst Cassirer and various historians of the Renaissance sometimes view Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance, as being primarily Platonic. But she doesn't agree with that. She said, no, the Renaissance was really Aristotelian. There are some historians of purity strongly support that view, such as Paul Christeller. He was one who was like that view. This view says Aquinas' revival of Aristotle was not only good in itself, but led to the Renaissance. Now, Descartes is another one on her list of philosophical bad guys. Because what Descartes did was, remember in his Meditations, he said he wanted to try to doubt everything that he possibly could. He said, well, could he arrive at something that he couldn't possibly doubt? And he said, yes, he could. This would be the idea that if he himself was thinking, he said, I can't doubt that I'm thinking. So he's starting from his own consciousness, and then he goes on from there to try to use the existence of the external world, existence of God, and so on. So her objection to Descartes wasn't with specific details of how he was trying to prove that the external world existed. She rejected the whole way he was looking at matter, and the objection was called it an inside-out philosophy. See, in this kind of philosophy, you're starting with your own consciousness, you say. You're starting with your own thought and say, well, given that I can't doubt my own thinking, what else can I deduce from that? So this, in her view, is rejecting the primacy of existence. It's saying we're starting with consciousness, not with existence. And this is not the way you're supposed to proceed, according to her. Now, we now get to the greatest villain of all in the history of philosophy. Now, one thing I think is interesting in Rand's thought, you know, she was a very gifted novelist. She knew how to tell a good story. So she's able to look at the history of philosophy and make it kind of a really interesting story where there's battles going on. And for her, the chief philosophical enemy was Immanuel Kant, because what Kant said was that the mind constructs reality according to a certain set of categories. According to Kant, we don't grasp the world as it is, but we, in order to make coherent sense of experience, we have to have certain concepts and principles that we start with and don't acquire from experience, but we look at the world through these concepts, and in that way we acquire knowledge of the world. So what we really acquire is the knowledge of a world that we construct, not knowledge of a world that's out there, independent of us, completely that we grasp. The world is constructed by it. So Rand says this inaugurates modern irrationalism, this view of mind constructs reality. And according to her, in Kant's successors, such as Hegel and Nietzsche, the view that the mind or will makes up reality becomes even more blatant. And this approach will underlie postmodernism as well. So to be clear, what she's objecting to here is, she said, Kant and his successors thought that the mind really constructs reality. Remember, according to her, no, it's the mind doesn't have independent content. It's directed outward toward the physical world. It's the physical world, the world given to the senses, that's primary, according to her. So now, the fundamental point in objectivism that I've already mentioned several times is that philosophical ideas are not merely a theoretical important. The reason she's concentrating so much about metaphysics and epistemology isn't just that she finds these interesting subjects, but she thinks these are of vital practical importance. The world really turns on having the correct views on metaphysics and epistemology. In her view, ideas are the primary factor in history. Ideas are the most important thing in history, and philosophical ideas are the most important ideas. So in her view, having the correct philosophical ideas is really the most important thing in all of history. She sees history as really a battle of various philosophical ideas that are competing with each other. And we see this, there's a well-known book by Leonard Peikoff called The Ominous Parallel. Some of you may have read this. And according to Peikoff, the Kant's philosophy was really responsible for the Nazis, because he inaugurated the modern the belief in irrationalism, the belief that the mind constructs the world. And Peikoff argues that this led ultimately to the Nazis, not the thought they could remake reality according to their own will. They thought they didn't have to subordinate themselves to the facts of the world, but they could force reality to go according to their own racial fantasy. I must tell you one story. When I first read Peikoff's book many years ago, I didn't think too much of it. I think a little better of it than I did back in those days. But I wrote a review of it that got me into enormous trouble. So I have to be very careful what I say about Ominous Parallel. I'm sure I could be eliminated. Many people for what I've said about the book, but I think rather better of the book than I did at one time, and not to say that I agree with it, but I think it is one that's worth looking at. Now, I've so far said something about Rand's metaphysics, namely that she thought that the the world getting to center the primary mind that is directed outward in reality, with subordinate to the physical world. This existence of this is the primary the world that we see in center of the primary mind has to try to adapt itself, gain knowledge of that world. Now, how does the mind, how do we get knowledge? Is the question asked by epistemology, theory of knowledge. And Rand's philosophy has distinctive doctrines in epistemology as well as in metaphysics. So according to her, the mind begins as a blank slate. She doesn't believe in innate ideas or instincts. So mind just starts off as a blank slate. And through our physical senses, we grasp similarities and differences among concrete entities. For example, supposing I seem to like the color red, supposing I'm looking at various red objects, like a pencil, the red wall, red brick. I'm looking at various red objects. So before, according to her, before I have a concept of project as why then is the sun so many times like its father. Well, she's not denying that there's such a thing as heredity, but she just doesn't think that you inherit innate, you don't get innate ideas. In a concept, you get to start off blank. You just first see things, you perceive things through the senses. So imagine you're looking at all these red objects. You don't have a concept of red yet. But then you can see what the similarities and differences among the red objects are. You see they all have a certain shade in common, a certain color in common. Different in various ways. So you can get through a process of abstraction, you can get the concept of red. And then once you've got several concepts or abstractions, you can build them up into a very highly complex system. But all true concepts have to come from the senses, according to them. You have to derive these concepts from the senses. And if we have some concept that can't be ultimately derived from the senses, she thinks that concept is meaningless. According to her, you have to be able, if you have a certain concept, you have to be able to trace it to some kind of sensory perception. Now, someone suggests she would change her mind if she knew the way of development in neurology. Well, maybe she would. Her followers, though, haven't done so. I mean, they seem to want to continue to say that teach the view the way she held it. So maybe she would. I don't know. It's hard to say what she herself would have done. But she doesn't. She didn't seem at all sympathetic to views that say we have innate ideas. Now, this is her view of epistemology. Now, if our aim in philosophy is to respond adequately to the real world, to existence, this has definite consequences, according to her, for ethics. According to her view, a reality, an existence-based ethic, will be based on human biology. What sense is that true? Well, here again, this point that her view that man doesn't have instinct is of primary importance. If animals wanted to survive by operating on instinct, but human beings aren't like that, we have to use reason in order to survive. We can't just rely on instinct in the word patterns of behavior to stay alive, we have to rely on reason. So if this is so, according to her, the goal and standard of ethics for each person is his own survival. We have to be able to survive as rational beings. Now, this has consequences for politics and economics. If man wants to survive using his reason, he needs to establish a political system that recognizes individual rights, in particular property. And why is that? Why we have to have such a system? It's because establishing such a political system is essential for the function of the only productive economic system, laissez-faire capital. So here, she's very much along the lines of Ludwig von Mises, whose views on economics influenced her. She thought very highly of the economist. But what Mises stresses is that it's social cooperation through the free market that enables people to survive and flourish. This is a view that she very much held, that we have to have laissez-faire capitalism in order to survive, and that in order to do that, we need a regime, political system that recognizes individual rights. So if under this system, the government is strictly limited to defense and justice, but she didn't agree with Murray Rothbard, his father, that you should have competition in protection agencies. She thought there should be, within a given territory, there should be one monopoly protection agency. She was a minarchist, not an anarchist. She very strongly rejected anarchism. She was a limit. Although she didn't like the term libertarian, I think she could be described as a limited government libertarian politically. So what I tried to do so far is give you an overview, contrast what was her stand on non-aggression. She agreed with that, but she didn't think that government in her sense violates the non-aggression. So what I'm trying to do so far is give you an overview of Rand's philosophical system, metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics and politics. So with this overview completed, in the Chase wants to know, we're going to explore basis for minimalism and anarchism. We'll discuss that, but that won't come up until a later lecture. Remember, for Rand, it's the metaphysics and epistemology that are most important, most fundamental. Then we have to cover her ethical system. So we won't get to political system until quite late in the course of the fifth and sixth lectures, I Should Live So Long. So now, with this overview completed, I'll just spend a little bit of time going over, saying some things about her metaphysics and epistemology. In the time, little time remaining, we'll just be able to cover a little bit of that. We'll go into much more detail in the lecture next week. Now, the fundamental principle of objectivist metaphysics is a law of identity, A equals A. And you have to take this together with the principle of non-contradiction. Nothing is both A and not A. So suppose I'm looking here, I have a bottle of water here. So I say, this bottle of water is this bottle of water. And it can't be the case that this is a bottle of water and this is not a bottle of water. That seems pretty commonsensical. And almost all logicians accept these laws. There are a few who question non-contradiction, but we can put those aside. In the way most logicians take these principles, they're purely formal. They would say no proposition that has the form A and not A is accepted. So it's just something you could take this kind of as a, like a mathematical formula. You'd say you have a, you see something that says A and not A, that's unacceptable. You just look at it and see just from the way something is worded that it violates this law. So it isn't really telling you all that much. It's just saying if you have a statement that has this formal defect in it, it has to be rejected, violating non-conviction. But the objective is understand the law of identity in a much more far-reaching way. To understand their position, we have to take account of certain philosophical doctrines they reject. And here the fundamental essay, key essay, is by Leonard Peikoff, called the analytic synthetic dichotomy. If you can get a hold of a copy of Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, I think it's available in paperback, not very much money, it has this essay in it, so if possible, you can try to get a hold of this and read it. Now, philosophers often distinguish two types of statements, analytic and synthetic. An analytic statement is one that's made true by the concepts of which it consists. And a synthetic statement is one that's known to be true only through experience. Now let's look at an example that will make this distinction clearer. Suppose we take the statement, all bachelors are unmarried. Well, we don't have to keep testing to see whether we can find bachelors or exceptions. We don't have to look around and say, oh, well, all the bachelors we've looked at so far turned out to be unmarried, but here's one that is married. It's true by definition that bachelors are unmarried. We're not going to be able to find anyone, bachelor, bachelors are unmarried. You're not going to be able to find a bachelor that's married because that would go against the definition of bachelor. Now consider by contrast the statement, bachelors tend not to live as long as married men. Now this statement, if it's true, I don't know if it is true, but suppose it is, this can be shown to be true only through testing. We can't find out just by understanding what the statement means, whether it's true. You can understand what does it mean that bachelors tend not to live long as married men. We certainly understand what that means, but that doesn't tell us whether it's true. Then we have to go out and investigate. Now, objectivists don't accept this distinction. They think there isn't a separate kind of truth that it's the truth of meaning apart from the empirical world. They say there isn't this separate realm of truth apart from the empirical world. It's just a matter of truth by definition. So according to them, there aren't analytic propositions. There isn't a special kind of proposition. It's just true from the meaning of terms without reference to the empirical world. Now, related to the analytic-synthetic distinction is another distinction, that between the a priori and a posteriori truth. An a priori truth is one that can be known to be true apart from experience. An a posteriori truth requires confirmation through experience. Now, many philosophers, but not all of them, this distinction lines up with the analytic synthetic distinction. That what those philosophers would say was, well, suppose some statement is analytic, like all bachelors are unmarried. Well, we don't have to test this through experience, so it's a priori. If you take this other statement that I gave, bachelors tend not to live as long as married men, then this is synthetic proposition, and it's one we can't know to be true by thinking about it. So it's a posteriori. So according to some, but not all philosophers, this analytic synthetic distinction lines up exactly with the a priori and a posteriori. It doesn't, in Kant's philosophy, Kant thought there could be propositions that are known just by thinking about them, they're a priori, but at the same time, they were synthetic. They weren't analytic propositions. We don't need to go into exactly why he thought that. Just to see what the two distinctions are. Now, as you would expect, objectivists reject the a priori because they think that all truth comes from experience, so there aren't any a priori truth. I want to mention a third distinction. You'll be glad to know the last one of these distinctions. This is between a necessary and contingent truth. Now, necessary truth must be the case. It couldn't have been otherwise. We could distinguish various kinds of necessity, like logical necessity, metaphysical necessity, physical necessity. We can go into that in discussion if you'd like, but we just want to grasp now something necessary must be the case. A contingent truth could have been otherwise. Well, when I say it's a necessary truth that 2 + 2 = 4, it couldn't have been the case that 2 + 2 = 5, keeping the meaning of the numbers constant. It has to be the case that 2 + 2 = 4. Now, contingent truth could have been otherwise. I suppose I said that I'm now giving a lecture. Well, supposing we hadn't been able to solve the problem we were having at the beginning about getting proper sound, except we have solved it, then I wouldn't have been giving a lecture. But that was certainly possible, wasn't it? The sound just wouldn't have worked at all. So the statement I'm giving a lecture now is just contingent. It could have been otherwise. Now, this distinction also often but not always lines up with the other two. So we would have on the one side analytic a priori and necessary. On the other side, we have synthetic a posteriori and contingent. And again, not all philosophers would line up these distinctions in that way, but many do. Now, you would, again, I've given this one already on clarifying the distinction. All bachelors who are unmarried can't be false. There's no possible world in which bachelors are married. But even if it turns out in the actual world, bachelors live less long than married men, this need not have been the case. We can easily imagine that it might have been the case, turned out bachelors live longer than married men, even if this isn't the case in the natural world. Now, you would probably expect objectivists to reject this distinction too, and they largely do so. But the way they reject the distinction will surprise you. Since they reject analytic truth and also a priori truth, you would expect them to reject necessary truth at all as well. This is exactly the path taken by a very influential 20th century philosopher, W.B.O. Quine, who rejected the analytic synthetic distinction, the a priori, just as the objectivist. But he said, well, then there aren't any necessary truths either, so everything is contingent. But the objectivists don't take that way of proceeding. They reject all contingent truth except for human choice. They say their human choices are contingent. That I could have decided not to give this lecture. Probably happier if I decided. But that continues that I decided to give this lecture. But with the exception of human choices, everything that exists in the world exists necessarily. So there are no, other than human choices, there are no contingent truths. So for objectivists, all the properties of an entity are part of its essence. They're eccentric thought. So only we find out light travels at 186,000 miles per second. So as long as we measure correctly, light must do so. This is a defining characteristic of light. So the objectivist understanding of A is all embracing. The law of identity requires that all an object properties hold a necessity. So it couldn't have been the case if light traveled a different speed from the one it actually had. Now, another part of their view of identity, if an entity's properties are necessary, then its causal properties are necessary. Say, if I can cause, if, say, what would be a good example, suppose I say the earth can cause an object to fall toward it by gravitational attraction, that's an essential property of the earth, that it has this kind of causal property. So also they hold that nothing can come into existence without a cause. Now what follows if nothing can come into existence without a cause? Well, then the ultimate material constituents of the world have existed eternally. You see why that's the case, because if they're ultimate, nothing has caused them, as if something caused them, whatever caused them would be the world they are. So then they have to exist eternally because nothing can come into existence. So since the ultimate constituents haven't been caused, they have to exist eternally, because otherwise they couldn't exist at all. And no other set of ultimate existence is conceivable, because whatever exists, either in choices, exists necessarily. So the set of ultimate constituents of the world that we actually have necessarily exists. So I think I went a little over. I was planning to lecture originally 6 to 7, but we had these problems with the video, so I went a little over. So we'll now have, in the time remaining, I'll stay beyond 7:30, we can have for questions, objections, comments. I hope people are still there. We're going to have a little break to adjust the, we have an expert here at the Mises Institute. We're going to have a little break and just we'll have a chance to use the restroom. He's going to adjust the audio. Why don't we meet back in a few minutes?
Hi guys, we're going to try and improve the audio for you if we can. In the meantime, you can post a question to the question forum or grab a snack or whatever you want to do. We need about 5 minutes. Can you hear me, Daniel? Danny, sorry. So, Ben, what would you like me to adjust? David says he can hear me. Danny, can you hear me at all? To read this slide. A further aspect of identity, if an entity's properties are necessary, its causal properties are also necessary. Further, nothing can come into existence without a cause. If we do this, so the ultimate material constituents of the world have existed eternally. No other set of ultimate existence is conceivable. The set we actually have necessarily exists. How's that? Any better? I probably should have read that louder, but... Okay, what about now? Does that sound any better? A further aspect of identity. Blah, blah, blah. And very important stuff that David's always talking about, and so on and so forth. Same as before. Danny, the WebEx volume is auto-adjusting downwards. Is that normal? The tree fell out. Can we hear it? Would we hear it? I don't know. Does this sound any better, Danny? What again? Okay. Okay, Danny, we're recording again. Is this still sounding okay? The digitized sound is probably because of the decibel boost in the system mic. Otherwise, it's not picking up loud enough. Okay, David, get ready to start your question.
Okay.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I'm back, and thanks to Riggs Armstrong for his help here. I hope you'll all bear with me. Let me see here. Here is a question here. Ayn Rand said it can either achieve life or happiness by being irrational. How then would she account for that in Stalin and Hitler lived much better lives than rational people suffering in tyranny? Well, she would account for that actually by just denying that they did lead much better lives than other people. She seems to think that if you didn't follow the precepts she considers the appropriate ones, then you're not leading a good life. They were certainly politically very successful, at least for a time, but she wouldn't think that they were better life. Let's see, anyone else think? Well, don't mention it. It ran, oh wait, here's one, I'm going too fast here. Did Rand ever discuss Max Stirner's book, The Beagle and its owner. No, she didn't. She would have rejected what Sterner said as irrational and based. He would be one who emphasized the primacy of mind rather than the primacy of system. Now, it is interesting. A lot, there are many current Sternerites who are ex-objectivists. We could have transition from objectivism, but as far as I know, she didn't. She never discussed Sterner. And now, Brian said they were actually unhappy, which is why they behaved irrationally in a progressively worse manner. I think she would think, Hitler and Stalin didn't have a proper metaphysics and epistemology, so that ruined things. Let's see, Charles asks, define a better life. Whose standard defines a better life? This we'll see later what she thinks about this, but basically, according to her, the standards of life are really defined by biology. So what do human beings need in order to survive? That for her is the standard. It's not something that particular people pick, but it's something for her that's given by nature. Now, Justin says objectivistic acts end up defining characteristics of life. He travels at 308 and the rest put forth by physicist observation. Why then do they reject the universe's finiteness as one of its defining characteristics when physicists have often proved by virtue of the same scientific method? Well, that's a very good question. They think that physical sciences are subordinate to philosophy. So since they think they have a good philosophical argument, that there can't be anything outside, anything other than the universe, according to them, it wouldn't make sense to say that the universe was finite, because then they would take that to mean there's possibly something outside the universe. I'm aware that some physicists wouldn't accept that inference. Some physicists would say, well, the universe is finite, but that doesn't mean there's anything else. But the objectivists wouldn't take it. What they would say, they have a philosophical argument against that. Physicist argument to the contrary based on wrong philosophical concepts. Justin said, he meant to send that this to everyone. Well, as long as he sent it to me, that's what counts. I want to make sure no one drops out because of bad sound quality. If you drop out of the course, I'm going to cry. Don't do that. Right, are there more questions? Anyone have any other questions? We still have some time. I started late. We had some problems. I'm going to stay a little longer. Sound is fluxy. It'll be better next week, I guarantee it. Can you hear me? Bill asked, how the categories you were discussing relate to the concept of apodictic truth as a term is used by Mises? Well, Mises by apodictic meant a truth that couldn't be false. Apodictic is one that's certain. So the objectivists, we accept that some truths are certain, they're necessary, but they would take all truths to be empirical. And Mises didn't hold that. Mises was someone who thought that there are a priori truths, and truths we can discover it just by thinking about them. And the objectivists don't hold that. So the problem they have with Mises wouldn't be over the word apodictic, but over the type of theory of knowledge that you tell me. There's a book published called Rand's Marginalia that has Rand's notes on various books that she read, including Human Action. And she was very critical of Mises on the knowledge of life, the economics, pretty much, but she didn't like the epistemology. So the question here, wait, I'm missing something here. What's Rand's thought on Darwin's idea? Well, that's an interesting question. The current objectivists tend to accept Darwin. They give they're very much against the intelligent design movement. But there's some indication that Rand herself was kind of to question human evolution. She thought that Darwin's arguments weren't that good, but I don't think that her views on that have been published. I understand she was personally a bit skeptical. Murray Rothbard is definitely also rather skeptical about evolution, but that's not something published. And let's see, I think we have some advice to Maureen to post a question somewhere else. All right, well, are there any ones who want to have more questions here? Oh, I should click this link. Okay. I did that. Okay. Oh, wait. This great question, Charles. What was the one Charles asked? Audio quality. Stop this. I hear something else here. It sounded much better. That's what we'll be using. Yeah, so don't lose my voice. Does Rand say that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is contingent? This app was Rand's necessary. No. She thinks that both statements are necessary. Everything other than a human choice is necessary. There aren't any contingent truths other than human choices. Neither 2 plus 2 equals 4 nor this app was Rand for human choices. I forgot my password. Oh, here, there, but I saw it. Now, could I get that? Wait a minute. Okay, so the question here was, Maureen asked, if nothing can come into existence without a cause in the universe exists, what was its cause? Well, according to Rand, precisely for that reason, that the universe never came into existence, it's always there. It doesn't have a cause because she's taking the ultimate constituents of the universe to be ultimate. There's nothing beyond them. So since anything that comes into existence has to have a cause, then the ultimate constituent can have a cause. And then nothing can come into existence without a cause, then the ultimate constituents have to exist always. You see the argument against if they came into existence, they would have to have a cause, but they don't have a cause, therefore they didn't come into existence, so then they've existed eternally. Now it seems they, Maureen says the objectivists need to go out of the process by saying the universe is not a completely exist, and thus that's true. It's a fundamental just there can't be proven even fact. Yeah. Now in this instance, no, you're getting it exactly right. That is their view. Universe is just not Okay. Now, Chase is not defining bachelor as an unmarried man if he's an entry. Well, it certainly is, but remember, but I'm not clear what's supposed to follow from it. Not that it's the content of the statement isn't a human choice. You're defining it in that way as a human action, but bachelor is an unmarried man is a statement, not a human action. You're actually defining it. Okay, well, we've covered Marine's question already. She was, I think, what she said is right. Of course, the objection is going to say they weasel out of God, but she said he's right, except the universe. Justin said, does she simply reject scientific evidence that contradicts her philosophy? She sounds like a whim worshiper. Well, I mean, again, she thinks she has philosophical reasons for rejecting certain parts of science. Like the objectivists also reject certain interpretations of quantum mechanics, indeterministic ones. They think they can rule those out on philosophical grounds. They don't accept string theory as an example. They do reject philosophical views. I mean, certain scientific views that go against their ideas. Charles says, how does she explain a raccoon's decision to avoid good food when coming to you? I think she would say that animals are operating on instinct. Well, I'm sorry this sounded terrible. This will improve. Oh, this is not good. Well, Paul, I hope you'll bear with us till next week. It'll be better next week. If you heard that, I hope you heard that too. We're doing better last year. Okay. Okay, Paul, yeah, we're counting on you. Did Ron Paul name his son after Ayn Rand? I asked someone who knew Ron Paul. He said no, it was just sort of the name he wanted to. Short for something else. Well, Chase, thank you, Chase. I'm sorry for all the problems. We'll try to do better next time on the sound. Maybe the sound will be all right next time, but maybe it'll be something wrong with the content. All right, are there any more questions? Anyone else have anything? Maybe we'll finish now. If there's any other questions. I'm sorry. I was trying to talk a little louder, you know, my natural voice is kind of soft, but I was trying to scream. Can you hear me now, Charles? Are you still there? Charles, come in. Oh, good. See, I'm much better when I yell. And now hear this. You must stay in the class or else. Okay, do we have any more questions? Rand would have been a fan of Zizek. Well, he's written favorably of her, but she certainly wouldn't like him because she would view him as an irrationalist, knowing that he's a supporter of communism and dialectical materialism. I don't have kids, but if I did, I wouldn't be trying to get them in using this computer. Probably use a foghorn. Will we get a text or a lecture? This person's nice. I like this person. Well, let's see. I think So Danny said, start the, giving some suggestions on how to get the, all that's way up there. Okay, wait, am I missing something here? Will we get a tax lecture? No, the best we can do is, you can listen to the lectures many times. One, if there's something you can't understand, just email me and I'll try to figure out. But if you'll be able, if you look at the slide, you'll get a very good, you'll get what was in the lecture section. I didn't really say in the lecture anything that wasn't on the slide. So if you go through the slide, you'll be able to understand what I said in the lecture. Yeah, Charles has one about self-ownership. Well, we'll get her views on property later on. And of course, she was in general sympathetic to self-ownership, but she didn't use it that term. Can I re-record the lecture? Well, that's a possibility if we can set something up. We'll look into that. That we might try to do that if I can set that up with Danny Sanchez. I'd be glad to do it, but that's really up to me. Oh, Danny will write up a transcript. Well, I don't envy Danny. Okay, well, thank you, Justin. I'm glad you're. Okay, thank you. Well, we're getting some good comments. Thanks, everybody. Okay, well, thanks, everybody. Hope to see you all next week. Thanks. Bye, everybody.